Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. On this week's episode, NAHU's Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman discuss the happenings during this week's congressional recess, including the submission of a stakeholder letter urging Congress to take action on balance billing and our own Operation Shout requesting members of Congress to sign on to a bill to fix Medicare's two-midnight rule. Just a reminder before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these channels ahead of being distributed through the Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. The big whoop for this week's Washington Update podcast is a letter NAHU submitted to House and Senate leadership from a diverse group of stakeholders representing employees, large and small American businesses, health insurance providers, and brokers who are working to make healthcare more affordable and accessible for every American. The letter asks that Congress take action this year to pass legislation that will protect patients from surprise medical bills and rein in out-of-control healthcare costs. How did this group of stakeholders come together?
Well, thank you, Husni, and it's great to hear your voice here this week, and I am glad to be back on the podcast because it's been, I think, a month since I've been on this. Been on the road, and we've had so many special guests. And, you know, we are missing Dan this week, who is off on paternity leave with his baby. So we've got a lot of different voices here this week. But let me talk a little bit about the group of stakeholders who are interested in this issue. This group came together with a bunch of like-minded stakeholders who want to protect consumers. So you have people like agents and brokers who work with individuals out there every day who are the ones who get stuck with these bills. You have the insurance carriers who also get these complaints by consumers, and you have the actual consumer advocacy groups together working together on this issue. So many of us are very concerned about the way surprise billing should go. No consumer should ever be stuck with a $30,000 bill from an anesthesiologist in the emergency room when they had no choice on being there. And we need to do something about this. But there's a right way to go about it and a wrong way to go about it. And that's why these stakeholders, I think, are so important together, because we're going to look out for the consumers who get these bills, but also the consumers who do not want higher insurance rates or higher costs overall by going about taking care of this problem in the wrong way.
And we know the policymakers are really interested in hearing from the stakeholders. Obviously, that's one reason why we came together and submitted this letter. We know that members of Congress want to hear from us, and they want to be able to point to this as a reason why they're taking action. But there's also a lot of pressure from policymakers outside of Congress. For example, Secretary Azar, he was one of our guests for Capitol Conference at the end of February. And when he was there, he spoke a lot about surprise billing and balance billing issues. And he said that he himself, as the Secretary of HHS, as a member of Trump's cabinet, has received a balance bill, that he could be the health insurance agent that works for the carrier that sells the plan that you are enrolled in, and you could still receive a balance bill. And so there's a lot of interest in this and coming together with the stakeholders and working with policymakers to try to come to some type of resolution.
It really is amazing how much of an expert you can be on healthcare and health insurance and still end up with a surprise bill. Even Sarah Cliff of Vox, who has been writing about surprise bills repetitively, became panicked when she was pregnant that she might end up in an emergency room with an emergency C-section and wouldn't know how to check through all the different anesthesiologists and others that they would be in the plan. I last year had a hernia operation, and yes, I made sure that my surgeon was in my insurance plan, the hospital was in the insurance plan, but that day of the actual surgery, I get to meet the anesthesiologist for the very first time. And, you know, we are highly trained people in health insurance. How's the average consumer actually supposed to go there? And why wouldn't you go to a hospital assuming everyone in that hospital is actually in network?
So what are some of the consumer protection aspects, and what are these stakeholders looking for specifically?
Well, what's listed in the letter is prohibiting doctors from sending a surprise medical bill to patients in cases of emergency, involuntary care, or instances where the patient had no choice in their provider. This is something that we've seen quite often in balance billing packages and ways that these stakeholders in general have tried to reach out, making sure that if you are not able to consent because it is something that's an emergency or involuntary care, that the consumer isn't held responsible for that treatment. Also requiring facilities to inform patients of their doctor's network status and possible options for seeking care from a different doctor, but not requiring patients to consent to out-of-network care. So here, in a non-emergency situation, making sure that facilities are alerting patients to the fact that their doctor may not be in network and allowing them to seek care elsewhere and not requiring them to sign a waiver to have that out-of-network care. Also setting reimbursement rates that will not increase premiums or impact access for consumers by basing amounts on market rates determined by reasonable contracted amounts paid by health insurance providers to similar doctors in a geographic area or a percentage of Medicare. This basically could cap reimbursement rates for certain practitioners that are out of network so that they aren't incentivized to continue to increase their rates because they could be reimbursed that larger difference and would require them to either stay at a certain percentage of Medicare or at a predetermined rate that is considered reasonable for the geographic area and the care that they provide. Other aspects are ensuring that protections apply to all health plans, including self-funded plans governed by ERISA. Right now, the balance billing provisions that are in a number of states and other aspects of balance billing provisions do not apply to self-funded plans. There are some states that have provisions that allow self-funded plans to opt in to be regulated by these, but it definitely is not something that all of the plans are raising their hands and asking to be regulated by. And then lastly, of the protections that the letter and stakeholders are asking for is to avoid the use of complex, costly, and opaque arbitration processes that can keep consumers in the middle and lead to higher premiums. And this really gets to the kind of end game of when you get a balance bill and oftentimes it's your agent that's helping you out, talking with the carriers and trying to go between the carriers and the providers and get to a resolution. The stakeholders here want to avoid going through a legal process called arbitration, which many times leads to a legally binding agreement of the payment process, but oftentimes doesn't resolve the larger problem of exactly how big that payment can be.
Is there any data that shows just how much different the billing can be between in and out of network practitioners?
Yeah, I think for what data is out there, there is a wide range. Most of the data we can get is actually from the Medicare side of things, because there's a lot of, well, recently there's become a lot of transparency on the Medicare side of the universe about what things cost. That is due heavily to actual legislation that Congress has passed requiring Medicare data to be put out there. There's obviously less transparency on what things cost when it comes to the more traditional employer-based side, individual market side, and things to that extent. But you can already see the wide ranges for a knee replacement, which is something fairly common within the Medicare universe. And you can see that within even a $20,000 range out there for a lot of these procedures. And what's, I think, also particularly interesting about that data and how much it ranges is when it's paired with actual quality information, too, there's very little correlation between quality and cost. So you can really see such a wide range of cost differences having very little to do actually with quality outcome.
And that point with the correlation between quality and cost is another reason why NEHU and other stakeholders are concerned about practitioners being able to use something that is included in this letter, but we do caution about how this calculation would be made, about charging what's reasonable for their area, for their practice. There's no guarantee that a practitioner won't say that they're an expert in an area and charging those expert fees, but not really having the data to back it up. And so charging exorbitant amounts, even though perhaps they can say that's what an expert would charge in this field, in this area, but do they truly qualify as an expert? There's no correlation to how that's really put together and who can charge that amount, which is why NEHU really prefers to see percentage of Medicare being used as the rate that could be influenced here for balance bills. Going back to the examples of using Medicare for some of the outrageous charges that we can use as a data point, in many cases, again, the charges bear no relation to the actual cost of care for market rates. For example, out-of-network anesthesiologists bill on average 580% of the Medicare reimbursement rate. And for emergency medicine physicians, the charges can be even higher, with one city finding the average bill to be 798% of what Medicare would pay.
And I think you make a good point about looking at what Medicare would pay versus what sort of the average market rate is. We have to be careful that if we look go down sort of the average market rate, will doctors be incentivized to try to actually raise that average over time? By everyone just presenting higher numbers to the insurance carriers and others, you actually raise the average of what the cost is. And again, do you encourage providers to leave networks altogether if we go down the average rate direction as opposed to tying it to Medicare?
So how do these points in this letter differ from the policy that was included in the Cassidy draft legislation from last year that we have talked about several times on the podcast?
This letter doesn't go into actual solutions for what we're asking on balance billing. It brings up the issues that we see with balance billing, what we think should be done to protect consumers, but it doesn't have a resolution or a proposal attached with it. The Cassidy bill did have a proposal attached with it, obviously, because it was a draft legislation. And with that, the proposal would have done some things that we weren't big fans of. It did have a lot of consumer protections, some of which are included in this letter. Things like providing notices when consumers are going to a hospital that's out of network, or in non-emergent situations, especially being made aware of any treatment that they could receive by someone who's out of network. But the Cassidy bill also would have required any difference in an out-of-network bill, a balance bill to a consumer, for the responsibility of that difference to be put on the employer or the carrier, depending on how that insurance plan was being funded. And our concern there was that the employers' and the carrier's pockets are only so deep. And if the employer or carrier are continuously put in the position of trying to make those bills whole, of making up that difference for the out-of-network costs, that we're going to see those costs passed on in the form of increased premiums for everyone. And so we really instead need to incentivize practitioners to be in network, or incentivize them to not inflate their rates because they know that they'll end up being paid by the carrier or some other entity, and really try to influence the practitioners to be in network and to charge reasonable rates.
Yeah, you know, I think you make a good point, and particularly about the cost of healthcare on this. You know, Congress gives a lot of lip service to wanting to reduce the cost of healthcare out there. But every time we take different aspects of healthcare, including the issue of surprise billing, you need to look at what those costs will be over the long term. If a doctor can submit any bill outside of network to an insurance company or a self-insurer and expect it to be paid, we're incentivizing people to create higher bills or just leave networks altogether, which eventually, yes, the consumer will be held harmless under the Cassidy draft, but eventually it's just going to cause health insurance to be more expensive for everyone. Because if the insurance carrier has to be prepared for any bill that comes in, regardless of how large it is, they're going to have to raise rates on everyone. And again, we're just making health insurance more expensive for everyone as opposed to actually bending the cost curve in the right direction.
For this week's Senior Moment, we called on our members who specialize in Medicare plans to take action on our latest Operation Shout to support legislation that would fix Medicare's two-midnight policy for patients placed on observation status. Last week, the legislation was introduced in the House by Representatives Joe Courtney and Glenn Thompson, and in the Senate by Senators Sherrod Brown and Susan Collins. These companion bills would allow observation stays to be counted toward the three-day mandatory inpatient stay for Medicare coverage of a skilled nursing facility. What is the difference between observation status and an inpatient stay, and why is this distinction so important?
Observation status is technically treated as an outpatient procedure, where an inpatient stay is obviously you have been admitted to the hospital, you are in inpatient treatment. With observation status or an outpatient procedure, this is billed differently under Medicare, and not as much is covered. And so this is one reason why it's really important that the distinction is made, because oftentimes very similar treatments can be given in outpatient treatment versus being inpatient and being admitted into the hospital, but it can be billed very differently. And this is where it becomes an issue with how it will then be counted, one, in the billing process for the consumer, and two, in how it's coded to lead up to, for inpatient status, We are trying to count the number of nights that they're in inpatient treatment to allow for them then to be able to go to, if a patient needs it, a skilled nursing facility or what we call a SNF, and have that care be covered. If they are treated as outpatient and get to the point where they need to be in a SNF, it's not going to be covered the same. And so even though there could be very, very similar treatments between the observation status outpatient procedure and the inpatient admitted procedures that have been done, the billing and the coding here is really crucial because it will end up affecting how that bill is coded for the patient down the line and what they're responsible for, as well as how their treatment may be processed later on and whether they'll actually get to the SNF and get that skilled nursing care that they need.
And Marcy, I think you make a great point, and the one I would like to emphasize about from the patient's point of view. From the patient's point of view, there might not be any difference between these two terms. These are really more about billing terms. They're more about hospital terms and insurance terms. From the patient's point of view, you might not see any difference between observation stay and inpatient stay. And so I think that's what makes it so difficult for consumers to know anything actually happened, because it looks exactly the same to the person out there. And your doctor's leading you all the way through this process, and you are just often in a position of agreeing to whatever the doctor is suggesting, and they're not notifying that you are suddenly headed in a direction that could be very difficult. And so this is really almost the same thing as we were talking about earlier in our conversation about a surprise bill. This is just a surprise bill on the Medicare side of things, mm-hmm. as opposed to the traditional insurance market. And it really is about how these things are coded and who the hospital is expecting to pay that bill.
What interests do hospitals have in coding a patient as observation status?
So the hospital does have an interest here, and a lot of people ask this about why would a hospital not code someone as inpatient, or why would they, because they have the ability within a year of treatment to go back and recode how a patient was treated, why a hospital would do this. And this is because hospitals are looked at by Medicare and rated by their readmission rates. And if a hospital has readmission rates that are above the national average, they receive lower Medicare reimbursements. And so a hospital wants to show that they are not continuously readmitting patients for some of the same treatment. They want to show that they are being very successful in how they're treating people. To show that they're not readmitting people, using that outpatient or observation status as how they're treating the patients is their way of preventing that patient from coming in and being coded as admitted and having to show that they are having these larger readmission rates. So observation status is a much better place for them to put a patient to try to make sure that they're still able to charge for the higher spectrum on Medicare reimbursement for their treatment. But as we just discussed, it is not the best for a patient.
Yes, yeah, so to make it very simple, I think they make more money off of going outside of Medicare. And that's unfortunately the way it works. And so there is unfortunately a financial incentive to go the other way. And this is something that we need to protect consumers from. And the role of an agent is often to protect their client.
So with that being said, what result does the difference in coding have on the patient and the patient's bill?
So like we were talking about, the coding has a difference in how the hospital is reimbursed and how they're treated by Medicare, but it also has a difference in how the patient is billed and how they are treated by Medicare. So if they are under observation status and treated in an outpatient manner, they are not covered as much by Medicare. And so they are going to see a larger bill, a Medicare surprise bill, like Chris said earlier. I think that's a great way of using the example. And they're going to see a lot of outside charges by the carrier that they're using with Medicare. If they are coded as inpatient, this is going to have a larger area of coverage by Medicare. They are not going to see as large of a bill that comes through for the portion that they, as a patient, are responsible for. They'll also be treated differently when it comes to not just their billing, but their actual treatment plan. And again, this comes down to whether they can be transferred to a skilled nursing facility and have that being covered by Medicare. Because they have to have 2 midnights or 3 days in inpatient care before they go to a SNF in order for it to be covered, if their bill is not coded as being inpatient and they go to the skilled nursing facility without having those two midnights as inpatient, they're also going to see an exorbitant bill from the SNF because they went without having those two midnights in inpatient care first. So that's another piece here that's really important about the difference of coding between observation status and inpatient care, and then also leading to how they will later be treated in a skilled nursing facility.
And Congress was at a session this week. Chris, what's on tap for next week?
So Congress is back in both the House and the Senate next week, although they've been doing quite a few town halls this week in their district offices and in their states. And I know we've had some agents and brokers go to those town halls. As you hear about town halls, I often encourage our members to attend, talk about our agenda, everything from reinsurance to the Cadillac tax to the HIT tax, but also bringing up the very important topic of opposing Medicare for All, I think is very important at those town halls. So just when they're in recess does not mean it's time for NAHU or you to lay off. It's actually time for you to engage. But for next week, we start heading with a series of different hearings on healthcare issues. And this is all starting to lead to, particularly in the House, what we do expect a package of healthcare bills to eventually be voted on. And we do not expect this package to be earth-shattering, but I do think this package will have a lot to do with things, some topics on the table that have been very important to NHU, such as the reinsurance issues. There are definitely several bills looking around short-term limited duration plans that will be discussed. And so several of these pieces of legislation are getting further hearings on the House side. And I expect that, and we understand that they're working towards trying to move a package of bills at the end of the month that would have a large impact on healthcare. They are not Medicare for All directions or anything to that extent, but have a particular impact over on the health insurance market. We're trying to craft those bills, trying to see things included in there related to the HIT tax and the Cadillac tax, some employer reporting. Those are the type of things we'd like to see included in the package. But we're going to stay involved in this. While the package might not be earth-shattering, it is hugely important topics like reinsurance to the way the individual market works, to the way the employer market works. And we're hoping that this can be a package of improvements on the system and not things that will have negative consequences.
It's now time for this week's Toast of the Week. Marcy, what are we toasting to?
This week, we are toasting to NAHU's Director of Policy Engagement, Dan Sampson, and his wife, Carrie, for welcoming their son, Theodore Douglas Sampson, this week on March 20th. Congratulations, Dan, Carrie, and Teddy.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us on this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.